Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. It's our pleasure and privilege tonight to be talking to Julie Clark, whom we did engage with last year with The Last Flight, but mm-hmm. that was a Zoom event. And now we get to actually see her here in person for The Lies I Tell, which is a really crackerjack book, which we're going to discuss to the degree that we can. So thank you all for coming to join us.
Thank you, Julie.
It's really very nice to meet you
Thanks for having me. I know. It's so lovely to be here.
So tell us a bit about that. Actually, didn't you write something before The Last Flight? Maybe I'm not going back far enough.
I did. I wrote a book called The Ones We Choose, a contemporary fiction, about a single mom who is a geneticist, and she conceives her son via donor instead of through divorce or death. I wanted to kind of write about a different kind of single mom that wasn't sort of your typical, like, tragic, you know, by default, like a person who chose being a single mom. And so it's about her son and how he kind of struggles with sort of figuring out where he fits in the world.
And then you decided to move more into the thriller genre.
And then I wrote The Last Flight and sent it off to my agent, and she said, this is a thriller, so you need to figure out how to make it a thriller, because it's not a thriller mm-hmm. yet. And so I had to figure out how to make it a thriller. I didn't know anything about writing a thriller at all. So I had to talk to a lot of my thriller writing friends, and I had to do a lot of research and read a lot of thrillers to figure out how to get that pacing right. And that one just went gangbusters.
It did extremely well. But mm-hmm. tell me more about it. She said it's not a thriller, you can make it one. What was involved in that?
Really tightening up the pacing, I think, and really kind of hitting what she called the beats a little bit harder, like the turning points, the twists, making sure the reveals were drawn out. And, you know, I had just written it as a story of two women, you mm-hmm. know, and it really, I had to kind of turn it on its head a little bit and make it a little bit more, withhold some things and reveal some things and connect some things in a way. So I had to pretty much rewrite it completely.
But the basic storyline remained the
same. Yes, yes, yes. Two women who trade plane tickets at an airport as a way to disappear. Yes.
Right. And did you always have that ending in mind?
Yes, I did. Yes.
I wish we could talk about it. Rats.
Yes.
We cannot.
Right. I did.
So did that provoke a lot of discussion?
The ending? Absolutely. I got a lot of messages, a lot of emails, a lot of, you know, notes from readers that, you know, they either loved it or they didn't love it, and they wanted to know why, and they wanted to know what my thinking was. And for me, it just felt like the truest ending to the book. It just felt realistic, and sometimes, you know, that's what happens without, I know, I'm trying not to say anything
to reveal it.
I
know,
yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
I found it really interesting. You don't know this, but your editor actually sent it to me to read. And I wrote her back and I said, it's the wrong ending. And she wrote back and said, it's the one we've got.
I love that ending. I'm partial to that ending. I'm not, you know, it's just the way that I write books, you know.
It's your book.
Yeah.
You absolutely should write the ending that you like. But I wondered if I were the only person that would react that way.
No, so a lot of people did. And then I got a lot of messages from people who loved it and said, no, that's absolutely the perfect ending for it. But, you know, I did a pre-order campaign with this one where I wrote the alternate ending. So if you didn't like the book, you know, I wrote the alternate ending for people like you who needed something a little different.
Well, I didn't for this one.
Yeah, no, not with this one.
It was just the other story. But anyway, we can't tell you what it was that I was thinking about. It wasn't that I didn't like it. It's a long story. Read Gone with the Wind. And when you get to the end of Gone with the Wind, you'll sort of see what I'm talking about. Because I really like the way Gone with the Wind ended.
Yes.
So we move on to The Lies I Tell. It's not that often we get what I would call a really great con. I love people, you know, that's a confident, it's short for confidence trickster is basically what it is. I like heist novels too. I love a really great heist novel.
Yeah, me
Not
too.
Not every crime fiction has to be about murder. You know, it just doesn't. And so it's refreshing to see a book turning on some other kind of activity besides, you know, serial killing or whatever it all is. So are you yourself experienced in the con?
Oh yeah, very. I con people all the time. I had to do a lot of research. So I got the idea from listening to a podcast called Who the Hell is Hamish, which is an Australian podcast about a man who was conning women, getting them to fall in love with him, getting them to give him tens of thousands of dollars for can't lose investment opportunities. And I was listening to it and I just was thinking, like, I think a woman would be better at this. Like, I just think women are a little less threatening, you know, we're a little more approachable, we're not as suspicious as men. And so I thought, now if I wrote a female con artist, why is she doing that? And so then I had to go back and do a lot of research about con artists in general, mm-hmm. and sort of the psychology of how they do it and what they try to, how they get their marks to sort of fall for whatever it is that they are selling them, basically. And what it comes down to is that they prey on people who are vulnerable whenever they can. So they look for people who are going through major life transitions or have gone through major life losses. And then they figure out what it is that that person wants the most or thinks they need the most. And then they convince that person that they are the only one who can give it to them. And that's how they do it.
So generally a mark in a con game is somebody who's willing, you know, or at least is participatory.
Yes.
Yeah, needing to, at least
needing
is participatory.
To. I think so.
So
yeah.
While they are the victim, in some respects, they victimize themselves.
Sometimes. I mean, I think that, you know, everybody wants to sort of find you want what you want, right? Mm-hmm. And if somebody's offering it to you, it's like that beware of something that's too good to be true, you know? But when you are in the middle of crisis, you're not thinking clearly. And so you're just seeing a way out of whatever that crisis is and that person is offering to you. And it's all very orchestrated.
So you're putting a lot more intelligence in it than the average Nigerian prince, for
yes,
example.
Yes, I would think, know. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
I got one of those the other day, not a Nigerian prince, but an email about, didn't you get my message about a book offer or, you know, talk about books or something? And they sent it as text to my email.
Huh.
So, you know, I couldn't read the actual email. So the object was to get me to click
on a link.
Right.
Yeah.
So my husband has trained me really
yes.
well. So I directed it to him in the back room. And I said, you know, is this one I want to open or not? Back comes no in giant flaming letters.
Right.
At all. But I think to myself, you know, how easy it would be. Not because I'm in a crisis.
No.
Degree, but I'm
you're just not
busy,
thinking.
You know?
Yeah, and, exactly.
And it looked like it could
yes.
be sort of a regular email that, you know, I would get.
And I think that there's a lot of different kinds of cons, and there's cons like that where people are just trying to get you to click on a link so that you can download something to your computer and they can kind of hack your computer, right? That's one way.
Right.
You know, identity theft is another con, but my main character Meg is in for like the big bang con. Like she likes the long con. She wants to really work it and get infiltrated into somebody's life, and she targets very specific people as her mark. She doesn't just con anybody. And she really kind of is very thoughtful about how she approaches people. She finds other people. She uses social media heavily to find other people in their life that she can approach first, so that when she actually meets the person that she's targeting, there are people in that person's life who have known her for a little while and can vouch for her. So she's even less threatening than she would be if she were to just make a cold approach and try to get somebody to befriend her.
Well, what's her goal? Is she after money? Is she what's she after when she does this?
Well, I think you need to read the book.
Oh, I have.
But, yeah.
Well, I mean, most of the time you think about it, it's just going to be money.
Yes.
But, you know, what is it she's looking for? But
she's looking for something else besides money. The money is good, and she uses the money to great effect.
Mm-hmm.
She uses the money to fund future cons. But she has an ulterior motive. She has a man in Los Angeles who she believed destroyed her childhood, basically stole their family home out from under them. And her goal is to go back and take him down. And he's not a nice guy. And so she kind of goes out into the world to sort of train up as a con artist so that she has all the skills that she needs, so that when she returns, she'll be ready to pull that one last final con. And it really is her last con. She doesn't want to do this forever. She doesn't love it. She's very good at it, but it's a lonely life, I think. And so she doesn't know, though, that there is an investigative reporter waiting for her back in Los Angeles who was collateral damage on a con that she pulled a long time ago, who wants her own revenge. And so she's not aware that there's somebody waiting for her.
You know, for some people, the con is just a lifestyle, you know, they're mm-hmm. not suited for regular
yes.
employment
no.
or whatever it is.
No.
And so, you know, so they don't give it up. I think it's like an addiction, like gambling or something, you know, better than a real job and all that kind of thing. So it's interesting to have somebody that's goal oriented as opposed to
Yes, I really wanted to write a morally gray character that you as the reader would root for. Mm-hmm. That was important to me. I just didn't want to write a two-dimensional con artist where you're like, oh, she's terrible. Oh, no, don't fall for it. Don't fall for it. You actually want her marks to fall for it. You're rooting for her. And that was particularly fun to write, to get her to be a little bit more three-dimensional, to understand a little bit more about her backstory, to understand sort of what she struggled with. And then, you know, even though she's doing things that are not good, you want her to succeed.
So social media, boy, you know, you really pointed out the mm-hmm. enormous danger mm-hmm. of people who lead their lives on social media.
Yep.
You know, who post their kids, their, you know, their homes, their right. families, their vacations, whatever it all is. And, you know, anyone in the world, even if you have your Facebook account set to privacy, you still are at risk, certainly with, I don't know. Can you do that with I'm such an unsophisticated Instagram user. Can you actually lock people out?
You can block people on Instagram,
but you have to know who they were, right?
Yes. And so, you know, you can have a private account, but like for a public figure, that doesn't work, right?
Right.
Like I can't have a private account because that defeats the purpose of being there to promote my books.
Right.
So it's a public account and I am very mindful of what I put on there.
Yeah, I'm really horrified because I do the store Instagram. I wander through, and I'm just horrified at seeing people who put their kids up, and you know, there are people mm-hmm. who record like all the
moments of their life. Yeah,
they do. And this came up the other day because there is a child whose picture. Do you remember what it was?
The Nirvana baby.
Yeah, that was
Nirvana
baby. Mm-hmm. And he's on the cover of the album that mm-hmm. made him. And anyway, he's now suing for, invasion of privacy plus all the money he didn't get?
Something like that.
I think there were two prongs to the whole thing. One is that the picture, because he was just was taken without his consent. And two, that it contributed to the success of the album and therefore can get paid for it. But, you know, the people, I'm trying to remember if he's actually suing his parents. Might be. But that's
what
been...
I read somewhere that he wanted to sue his own parents. That's what I read.
Well, there are instances where people have sued their parents. There was a Jodi Picoult book years ago that was really powerful about suing... You remember the girl that her sister had leukemia and her parents, she thought, had her just to be a donor.
Just to be a donor
and
for
she
her sister.
Eventually,
her sister's keeper, that's what
it was
called.
That was a really powerful
Very
book.
Very good book, yeah.
But she sued her parents to be emancipated, so she didn't have to play that role. But I brought this up before, that Chrissy Teigen and John Legend, there isn't a day that goes by that their kids are not plastered all over Instagram doing stuff. And I wonder, they're little, you know, what will happen when they grow up?
Well, I think that's one issue, but I also think that the bigger issue as far as like putting your whole life on social media is that you don't really realize what you reveal when you're just mm-hmm. posting updates, right?
Right.
And so I wanted Meg, my con artist, to kind of highlight that for readers, of those little quizzes that you take about, you know, name five places where you've lived. And, you know, like I just think all of those things are just bait for somebody to come in and pretend to know you based on all of those quizzes that you've taken and things that you've answered and, you know, how many miles do you live from the place where you were born? Like, all of those things are just, and they're not always quizzes. They're just sometimes they're little like posts that get shared over and over and over again, and more people see them and comment, right? Oh, I live 5 miles from where I was born, or 10 miles. And it's like, it's not really hard to figure out very quickly, you know, and once you reveal like the location where you were born,
that data.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, Meg uses that to great effect. She infiltrates secret groups. She's in a divorced group. She's in other hobbyist groups. And she's just looking for people sharing their stories, and finding targets that way.
I think there's an illusion of privacy that we all suffer from, or most people suffer from when they're talking on their phone in a mm-hmm. crowd, they mm-hmm. somehow think. Mm-hmm. We had an experience last Christmas up at La Posada where we were sitting by the fire and some woman came in and plunked herself down, put her phone on speakerphone, and then went on and on about the relative that had died and the funeral arrangements and all, just went on forever. And she finally, I mean, there was never a good moment to interrupt her. When she finally hung up from that call, we breathed a moment and then we realized she was about to do it again. And at that point, you know, I decided to forget about good manners.
Right.
And I said to her, you know, if you're going to make another call, we'd appreciate it if you would go somewhere else. And she went like, well, we've had a family loss. And I said, yes, we know.
We heard the whole conversation.
We now know.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm really sorry about it, but we don't want to participate in this process for you or whatever. People I would have congratulated me on speaking up. And I really did think about it because, you know, it's hard to be rude. I mean, it feels
confrontational,
rude, but
yeah.
She was rude,
yeah.
You know. But the thing is, she thought she was in a bubble.
Yeah.
And so that's another way that we...
I think so, yeah. You know, I think we just go... We're so used to being behind a screen, I think, mm-hmm. that we forget when we're not. You know, and we go out and live our lives thinking that no one is looking, but everyone is. So, and maybe people you don't want to look.
Like NSA, for example.
Yeah,
it's really scary when you think about how, if mm-hmm. we, you know, clearly some of the events that have happened, you know, demonstrations and other stuff reveal that NSA isn't actually looking. Because if they were, they would have done something about it, you know, slow off the mark. Well, the Uvalde thing even, for example, you know, he posted ahead of time what yeah. he was going to do. And if people were really monitoring everything you did, then one would wish that they had taken some action. But we're kind of moving that way. And now that we're going, the virtual reality thing is becoming more and more of a deal. Now you wonder if people are not even going to lead authentic lives. While they're, so are they going to feel even safer
know.
And
yeah.
therefore be more vulnerable?
I don't know.
Well, something you might write about.
Maybe I will.
So what is it that, you know, that interests you in a story? I mean, you know, this is a variation on where do you get your ideas.
But. You know, I usually come up with a nugget of an idea, and it's usually a character first. So okay. Meg came to me for this book first. And it just a story sort of grows around that idea of who's this person and what is it that they want, what is it that they need. I generally try to think about what is it that they want more than anything, and Meg wants revenge more than anything. And then I have to figure out, like, well, what is it that she actually needs? And those two things need to be in conflict in order for there to be any kind of tension in the story, because what she wants and what she needs, if what she wants and what she needs is the same thing, then it's like, yep, good, got it, right? And so there has to be some kind of character arc and character growth and character change. So I really have to kind of dig deep into my characters and figure out who they are and all of the things, all of the life experiences that they've had that have made them who they are, so that when you're meeting them on page one, they have lived these rich lives that have had good things and bad things and neutral things happening to them, so that they feel real. And you won't see all of those things, but they will show up on the page and the choices that they make and the things that they say, the things that they don't say. And that, I think, kind of helps propel a story forward, and then I build the plot around that. I don't usually start with plot. I usually start with character.
So basically, you never really eat a meal alone. You've always got these characters
basically,
with you.
Yeah.
Right. I read that line somewhere. I can't remember exactly how it was, but I loved it. It was something about, you know, if you're a writer, you never have to dine alone or something.
No, you definitely don't, because you're always thinking about them and you're always wondering and rethinking and, you know, trying to figure out their relationships with the people that they're interacting with and rewriting those again and again. Maybe they're estranged. Maybe they're gently not estranged. You know, you just have to constantly go back and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until you hit the perfect note of where two characters are in whatever relationship they have.
So really, you're starting with the why done it rather than the who done it.
Definitely.
Or whatever.
Yes.
I think, you know, why done it is sometimes plots get lost in the why done it.
Sometimes.
You know, they don't always really spring from why. And I agree with you that I think the most moving ones are when people have real motives for doing it. But it seems to me, since this is your second, third mm-hmm. novel and mm-hmm. standalone, basically then what you have to do is you have to engage in world building with every book.
Every book, yeah.
And only some people like to do that. You know, it's an interesting. Some writers really love writing series because then, you know, they've already mm-hmm. built that world and then it's a whole different dynamic. Whereas others really enjoy, right? We had a talk with Riley Sager, was it last week? I think it was last week.
Yeah.
And basically the same conversation.
Yeah.
He had written either two or three books in a series.
Right.
And had not really engaged him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wrote Final Girls and recognized that he liked the whole act of creation.
I'm the same way. I feel like, you know, I've been with these characters. They've done what they needed to do. They've learned whatever lessons they needed to learn. Like, we're moving on now, you know. Different show, different station, new problems, new characters, new life, new everything. Just it's fresher, you know. I don't know that I could write a long-standing series because I think I would be the same. I think I would get a little bored of just keeping it fresh, you know, like, I mean, Sue Grafton is the one that did it so brilliantly, but
Michael Connelly does it really
well,
too.
Yes, he really does do it very well.
I mean, I just think, you know, it just seems to be like how your mind works. You know, what engages you as a writer, and, you know, is it starting
creating
with a fresh
character?
Bitch?
Yeah, and I think that for authors of series, they may not enjoy creating the character as much as I enjoy creating the characters, you know, and so... And they probably, I would imagine, enjoy the growth of the characters across several books and how they change and, you know. But for me, I just like starting fresh with a brand new situation and a brand new person and a brand new everything. I like that.
That's what you like.
Yeah.
Actually, in most long-running series, if you guys read them, you'll notice that there's almost always at some point the backstory novel, the prequel, or Mark Rainey did a brilliant job in Sierra 6 of working in the Gray mm-hmm. Man's original story, not as a whole-blown prequel, but, you know, as part of the current story. And I think because you have to pick a point in time to start your character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's seldom when they're, like, just born.
No, never.
So,
I mean, what you want to do is you want the reader to walk in at the moment when things are about to happen and the reader has arrived just in time. I mean, that's sort of where you need to start your book. And it's hard to find that place at the beginning of a draft. It takes some time.
That's a really good point, just in time. We think about just in time inventory, the way to make your bookstore profitable is that you don't carry all the extra books. You know, you have one and you sell it and then you mm-hmm. get another one. Mm-hmm. It's called just in time inventory management. And so now I'm thinking about just in time character management.
Yeah.
You know, they show up.
Yeah.
But with the series character, that being true, because it'll be true just as for them as for
you. Absolutely.
Then the whole question of how they got to be the person they are when you got to them just in time almost always arises. And I think what happens is the author gets curious because the author has created this character.
Right.
Patrick, what do you think? Because, you know, we've had a chance to watch that happen so often. What do you think is the motivation?
I don't know. I mean, there's also with standalones, you know, you never know if the character is going to survive to the end of the book.
Yeah.
You know, and with a series, you know your hero is going to, or heroine, is going to live, you know, through the book. And that's probably the fun of doing standalones partly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's true. Everybody's in jeopardy.
Yeah.
Right. In a series, only the pets are safe.
In both the books, you have two women kind of circling around each other.
Yes.
In different ways.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, with this one, the women are literally circling around each other, trying to figure each other out and who's lying and who's telling the truth and what's, you know, how is this all going to play out? And at one point, you're not even really sure who Meg's true target is. With The Last Flight, they're not circling around each other because they're only actually in one scene together, which is at the airport where they trade the tickets. But you're with Eva in the backstory as you're seeing her life lead up to that day in the airport. And you're with Claire moving forward in time as she is moving beyond that day in the airport. And so they're both very present. I mean, Claire's not really present in Eva's timeline, but Eva's definitely present in Claire's, because the whole point is to figure out, like, who is this woman and what is it that's going on here?
What can you tell us about Kat?
Kat is...
she's the other character, sorry.
Yeah, she is Meg, the investigative reporter who was collateral damage, like I said earlier, on a con that Meg pulled, Meg's first con that she pulled
10 years earlier,
and it destroyed her career. She was an up-and-coming investigative reporter at the LA Times. She had a great job. She had to kind of fight a lot to get the good projects. She was on a team of four people, I think, and they were all, you know, young men, and she was the only female. And so a lot of times she was like, had to go get lunch and stuff. And so she really had to kind of fight for the good jobs that, you know, she felt that she was capable of doing. And she takes initiative, and she maybe made a decision to put herself out there, got a lead, and put herself in a situation. But, you know, the thing about Kat is that, you know, Meg was partially responsible for that, and Kat blames her for it, but Kat is self-aware enough to know that that's a little irrational. Like, you know, like when you have trauma, you know you're not always rational about your reactions and your choices based on that trauma. You can know that, like, this is the trauma, I know I'm not being reasonable, and yet still need to deal with that trauma, right? And so Kat's decision to go after Meg and to take Meg down, to expose her for who she is, she's a con artist, she's gonna con this guy and she's gonna steal all his money, and I'm gonna be the one to expose her, and she has big dreams of maybe, you know, a big New Yorker piece, or, you know, The Atlantic or The New York Times, and maybe a book, and she's gonna get her career as an investigative reporter back on track. And she knows that blaming Meg isn't necessarily a rational thing, and yet she thinks this is how she's gonna balance the scales a little bit.
So for an investigative reporter, credibility would be like the thing that you most have to burnish. And
yes.
So if your credibility is dinged in any way, then, you know, we've seen journalistic careers, especially in the last few years of political reporting and so forth. We've seen journalists and reporters, you know, take a big hit where didn't trust that they trusted their sources, or they made up their sources, or whatever.
Yeah, no,
went wrong.
She's not going to do that. She's infiltrating Meg's life and trying to figure out what it is she's doing so she can expose her.
Right.
And she's going to, you know, she's undercover basically.
But she wants to turn Meg's life against Meg. I mean, that's the weapon that she's looking for.
It's personal.
Meg herself. Whereas in what I was just saying, sometimes in like the political sphere, you're trying to, you know, accomplish a goal by putting somebody else into. I mean, you know, the January 6th committee, I think, is a fascinating exercise in all of that. And surprising how it's picking up momentum, you know, because that's another question, is if some people have to reveal truth, will more people, you know, or will they run for cover?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a fascinating exercise to watch going on. And I often wish that I were 20 years younger so I could live long enough to see what anybody's going to write about the era we're living in. I'm afraid I'm not going to make it to see the measured response for all of it. But, It really is a fascinating time.
Yeah.
We'll all be sent to re-education camps.
Some of these dystopian novels may really come true. Yeah.
Yeah, it's feeling like it.
Interesting point. So basically, so we have Meg and we have Kat, and each of them has an agenda, and each of them is working on a con.
Yep. And so they're lying really to each other, and they're posing as people they're not, and
And so the charm of the book is to figure out, you know, to write it to the end. I don't know that you can figure it out until Julie figured it out. But it actually, did you know that? That's a really good question. Did you always know how it was going to work out, or did it work out as you wrote it?
I had a clear picture of how Meg's story was going to end. And I knew that pretty early and how I wanted that to go. Kat's was more of a surprise for me. And it came a little bit later, and I really needed it to be satisfying. So, yeah, I think
didn't have a revised ending for
this
book.
I was going to say.
No, I was very happy with this book.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we can't just keep coming back to the last slide. We can't discuss it. Right. So what are you thinking about doing next? Now, I know you're on book tour and you probably don't even want to be thinking about what you're doing
next. I'm working on another book. It's about a murder that happened in 1975.
A real one?
No.
Or one you've devised?
No. It's something that is not, it's not real. But two children were murdered. And the middle brother was suspected of the crime. He grows up to be a famous horror author. And his daughter is going to write the story, the true story of what happened as told by him. But it's going to be back and forth in time. So you're going to see.
That's a dangerous thing for her to start out doing.
You're going to see that what he's telling her is not necessarily what actually happened. So.
And an interesting question, too, is would he even remember at this point? You know, people's memories are really affected by both the passage of time and about what they wish to believe.
Yeah.
So we all kind of fictionalize our own stories as we move through time.
Yeah.
I certainly have done that.
He remembers.
He does.
Yeah. Huh?
Ooh,
yeah.
Sounds fascinating. Right. Yeah. So, Danny, do you have questions that you would like to ask Julie? Can you repeat the question?
How soon after I finish one novel do I start another novel? I generally get an idea for my next novel about halfway through whatever one I'm working on. So the one that I'm working on right now, I kind of started getting a glimmer of an idea when I was finishing up Lies I Tell. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Lies I Tell. I got the glimmer of the con artist idea when I was finishing up The Last Flight. And that's just seems to be how it goes for me. So, I'm always working on a book. Yeah, I'm always working on a book.
Thinking about future stories?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have like a notebook with ideas, and they don't come to me like, oh, that's a good one, I'm going to write it down. But I generally feel like if an idea keeps popping up again and again and again in my head, then I know that there's a story there. I just need to figure out what it is.
Right. Anyone else?
Other authors you really admire in this genre, we don't all know or hear about them enough, but you think are really cool?
I think Janelle Brown is incredibly talented. I think Amy Molloy is incredibly talented. I'm trying to think.
Have you read Michelle Richman?
No.
Because I thought her book last year was one of the very best. You don't have your magic machine here. Patrick usually bails me out when I can't remember something. Michelle Richman wrote a book last year, which I thought was extraordinary. It was one of our...
What was it called?
Well,
can't
while
remember.
I look it up.
Okay.
Somebody else can ask a question. Right. I will.
The thriller genre, especially among female thriller writers, is incredibly tight-knit. We are always supporting each other. It's a wonderful, wonderful community.
It's sort of male dominated, isn't it?
No. Not anymore.
I would say no. There's a big, strong core of smart female, Megan Miranda, Megan Abbott.
There it is. The Wonder Test.
The Wonder Test?
The Wonder Test.
Okay.
And it actually draws on, when you read it, you will see that it draws upon some actual events that happened that were very much publicized, but she has her own spin on it.
I think the cover there? Okay, I'll have to look that
really,
one up.
Really, really super book. The distinction, you have to think about thrillers have sub-genres. And if you're thinking about the big male action thriller, you're right. There are not too many women who are writing military thrillers. So you've got Kyle Mills, it used to be Vince Flynn. You've got Jack Carr and Mark Graney and, you know, all those guys. But there's something called dark academia, which is a set of thrillers that are set, you know, on campuses and so forth. So you could go all the way back to Gaudy Night by Dorothy Sayers. Mm-hmm. Ashley Winstead wrote one last year, mm-hmm. your same publisher, called
In My Dreams I Hold a Knife. And her next one, The Last Housewife, is very dark. But
it's very dark.
Very good.
Yep. I loved the first one. I thought it was terrific. But then you've got a whole bunch of stories that are more about women, not, you know, military hardware and stuff, but more like this book that she's
like domestic
about.
Suspense,
right?
Which I don't necessarily consider myself a thriller writer, although my publisher classifies me
as just
a thriller.
Because it sells better.
It does.
You know, it isn't that big a descriptor.
But it's a huge umbrella for a lot of different type. There's domestic suspense. There's mystery. There's all different kinds of things under that kind of umbrella. So
a lot of it is women's fiction on steroids would be kind of a good way to describe it. And you're right, there is, and particularly on Instagram, there is an astonishing community of all. We have Lisa Unger coming to kick off her book in November.
She's
another example.
Yep.
Karen Slaughter,
Kimberly
who will be
Bell,
here.
Kara Ruda.
Yeah.
Tons and tons. I mean, there's
Sherry
just,
LaPina,
yep.
Just a lot. And they're not, you know, an investigation, there's a different dynamic with the thriller, which Julie has already told us about, as opposed to like a police investigation or a private eye story, which generally proceeds in a chronological way, you know, and it involves, it has an instigating event, and then you try to figure out who did it, whereas this kind of book is
And then you've got like Louise Penny and like the cozy mysteries and
I wouldn't call Louise cozy, but
but she's like, I love Inspector Gamache.
Well, he's wonderful, and actually it slightly started out cozy, but then it took a big turn. Patrick, speak up. You know more about a lot of this than I do.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was
I'm contagious. I'm sorry.
let's see. Give me a second. I'll come back to me. I had a couple of questions.
Well, one of the things that there's been some debate about lately in books authors that Patrick and I have talked to is what is a noir? You know, what is noir fiction? Mm-hmm. Is it an inevitable downward spiral? Or it's easy to confuse noir with hard-boiled, but not all hard-boiled fiction is noir. You know, some of it can actually be hopeful. Some of it can be funny.
Yeah.
Got it.
You're back.
So I'm back. I left for a minute. People who are conned, you know, this book deals with it. Do they, or the children of people who are con artists, do their offspring automatically gravitate towards being con people?
Con artists?
Being con artists rather than being con person?
I don't know. I didn't do any research. You know, my characters don't have kids.
I was thinking of Meg's
father. Oh, Meg's... I don't think she really knew her father. I think you're thinking of Lucky.
Okay.
Yeah, the book Lucky, which was great. It's also about a con artist, and that is about a con artist whose daughter becomes a con artist. Yeah, but I don't think Meg's dad was like a soccer player, like a European soccer player, like who took off early. Yeah.
Gotcha. But how about point of view? That was my other question.
Okay.
Both the leads are first person point of view. Is that
right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you have that from the very beginning, that dual narrative kind of approach?
I did. I needed Meg to have somebody working against her, and I wanted that person to have their own agenda, and I wanted you to be real up close with both of them, because I wanted you, the reader, to know when they were both lying. which was a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of signaling you have to do in this book,
isn't
there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the title's provocative too, because it's like, who are we talking about?
Right, exactly.
Yep, it could be either I.
Yes.
Or
yes.
Both. Right.
Yes. And
it's not called The Lies We Tell.
No, and that was on the table, and I said I didn't want to do that because I wanted it to be unclear who is saying that.
You're lucky this isn't called The Girl That Tells Lies. that's a, you know, if you can get the word girl or woman in the title,
golden.
It's a really big deal. But no, I like the fact that there's no gender in here and there's really only the one pronoun.
Right.
Very well done. Also, I like the cover.
Yeah, they did a great job with the cover.
It's the mood is kind of, you know, the colors are very good for it. And the images where one, you've got the eyes of the character, and in the other ones, you've got the mouth. So it's kind of like not a full face of either one. But, you know, I think it's extremely well done.
They did a really great job.
Right.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, this is a rare event because this is how the real book looks. And much of the time when I get an advanced reading copy, I don't get a cover image at all. Or it'll be like an early version of the cover or something. And sometimes I come down here and I'm just like amazed when I see the book. It's like, really? This is the book? But in this case, they went to all the trouble actually presenting a reading copy that in fact fully represents the book.
Yeah.
So I give them big points for that.
They did. And they did a really great galley wrap to go with it. There was a box that if you, like, it had a pull tab along here and you could take half off and you could see the full face of her, and then put the top on and take the bottom half and you could see the full face of her. It was really cleverly done.
Designed to get booksellers like me to take a real interest. I unfortunately am a bookseller who throws away absolutely everything that comes with an advanced reading copy because I don't want the publisher or any of the, I don't want them to tell me what the book is about or what I should think of it.
Mm-hmm.
So they usually come with helpful letters and you all that. I throw it all away.
Yeah.
You know, I just do not want to be influenced by that. It needs to be like me and the book.
That makes sense.
Well, you know, that works better here. Do you do that when you're reviewing? Do you throw all that stuff away too?
I don't know if I throw it away. I use it as a bookmark.
Well, that's what I mean. You don't actually look at it.
Yeah. I'm very excited to bring you blah, blah, blah.
No, and I ignore the author quotes as well, although sometimes I use them in the newsletter when I write to you, because I think if I say one author said this, that if you like that author, you'll identify more easily with this. You haven't done all the work of reading the book like I have before I talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not deceptive marketing practices, but they're trying to actually create an algorithm similar to the Amazon one. You know, if you like this, then you will like that. So if so-and-so's name is on the cover of the book, the implication is that if you like that author, you will like this book. But that's
the goal.
Everything is compulsively readable. Or so-and-so on crack. Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing.
They're hard to write. Done blurbs, they're hard to write.
They are hard. Riley actually made a pitch for never writing blurbs at all. He was feeling pretty impassioned about it the other night, you know, like, skip these.
I mean, I'm always of the mind of, like, I'm always going to try to pull somebody else up, you know.
Well, there's no point in writing a negative book.
I'm not going to say no if I can't. Yeah.
I decided years ago there was very little point in writing a negative review unless I'm really outraged by something. And sometimes I am, and sometimes I do that so you won't think I like every book that, you know, that I talk about, but I think in general the not review is actually the most significant negative.
Yeah.
You know, just not reviewing it at all is just as effective.
I think so.
Anybody else have a question?
Yes.
I was curious if you were inspired by any classical writers, like a Jane Austen or Shakespeare, or any.
You mean a literary writer?
Yeah.
No, I'm mostly inspired and get most of my sort of training of reading more contemporary. I'm not a big classical reader.
What'd you do
reader.
Before you wrote novels? You had a whole
life.
Well,
I'm a teacher. I still teach. I teach fifth grade. Yeah.
So you learned a lot about crime right there, and certainly about cons. My God, you must have had like a living.
They're not very good liars, so no.
I know, but they really try.
They do try. They bless them. They do try. No, I teach fifth grade. And then before that, I was a graphic designer.
Cooper.
Yeah.
Wow, so
yeah, I worked
really
in fundraising and athletics. I worked at Berkeley.
Okay.
And yeah, I was a graphic designer before that. So I've had several careers and didn't really start writing seriously for publication until I want to say maybe 2012 or 2013. So it's relatively recently.
What got you interested in doing it?
I mean, I've always wanted to do it.
Oh,
and
you've
it just got to the point where it was like, if I'm going to do it, I guess I should do it. You know, I could talk about it all day long and not write anything and then, you know, keep getting older, which seems to happen. So I might as well do what I want to do and try it. And I have been pretty successful. I'm pretty happy.
So you fastened on the real secret of being a published writer. And the real secret is you have to write something and let it go.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you could stall forever on a draft and
definitely,
you know, never be good enough. So you'll never be a published novel.
Definitely.
But that way you'll never fail.
That's true, too. And there's a lot of failure in writing for publication. There's a lot of failure. It just happens. So
it does. I mean, there's a persistence and good fortune. Takes both.
Yep. I agree with that. I would agree with that.
Yeah. How's your relationship with your editor?
Oh,
we are live. But.
Yeah, wonderful. No.
She's a very good editor.
No,
like her
she's fantastic. She is smart and supportive and approachable and all the things that you would want in an editor. Yeah.
Yeah. She's great.
Yeah.
You had your hand up?
Yes, ma'am. So I've read both of these and I've got an extra copy of this, so I'm super grateful. So sorry, you seem very extremely complicated relationship. So the last flight had a very complicated relationship, as did these very complicated relationships, whether it was people they were conning or between both of them. So what is the inspiration for that? You said you were a teacher, right? You said you were a graphic artist, a graphic designer. So how did those evolve from, did they evolve from your personal life? Did you take those complicated relationships or
I think I'm just interested in complicated relationships. I mean, I think we've all had them. I think we've all struggled with them, right? And I think that, you know, when you're coming up with story ideas, you need to have problems in the story. Otherwise, there's no story there. And so focusing on a complicated relationship between two people, I find really compelling. You know, I like watching shows about complicated relationships. I like reading books about complicated relationships. I like overhearing conversations about complicated relationships.
Hanging out in a coffee shop.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just like to imagine complicated relationships. But yeah, I do. I really am drawn to them.
Did you watch Call My Agent?
No.
Oh my God.
That's the one with subtitles, right?
It's French.
Yes, and it has subtitles.
That's okay.
It's hard for me with subtitles. It's hard for me to follow along and
you wouldn't
watch
have
the screen.
Any trouble. And if you, it's like the.
I tried. I couldn't do it.
You really couldn't.
I couldn't do it.
It's the dean of complicated
relationships.
I know.
I really wanted
program.
To. Subtitles are so hard for me. Like, I just, my eyesight is just
I can't read dialect.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to my grave without ever reading Dickens, or I'm never going to read Vanity Fair because, you know, just rife with dialect.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm such a speed
like
reader.
Either.
It's like giant speed bumps, and I just can't do it. So
I don't like
sympathize.
It either. Yeah.
I know. I pretend to be
subtitles.
Well-read, but I'm actually not. In those cases, I just can't do
mm-hmm.
it. Ugh. Anybody else have a question? Are there any from the audience, Patrick?
Yeah,
are you
she has a question.
Sorry.
No, okay. I just was wondering, with your other job, you talked about teaching fifth grade and then also writing books, like almost about every other year.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is your writing schedule just like during a day? Like, when do you find time to write while also doing another job full time as well?
I wake up very early in the morning. I wake up at 3:45 and write until 6, and then I'm off to do all the other stuff. And so I give myself those 2 hours at the beginning of every day when I'm alone and nobody needs anything from me. I can count on nobody wanting those 2 hours. I have teenagers who definitely do not want those 2 hours. And I get a lot of work done in those 2 hours. I mean, I write on the weekends as well, and I write over vacations and things like that. But really, I can get a lot done in 2 hours because it's quiet and I'm focused and I don't have any others, nothing else I need to be doing at 4 a.m. Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a great time. My favorite time.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Any questions?
She's answered.
Oh, has she?
There was a lady who said that she wondered if you've worked in a bank at some point or.
Oh, no.
Mitigation.
But I did talk to people who worked at banks, and I talked to attorneys because Meg does use DBAs or doing business as or fictitious business names as a way to kind of change her name and change her identity, the different cities that she's in. So I did have to talk to banks about that and figure out how all that works.
Yeah, it's an interesting variation on multiple passports because, you know, she's doing this all in the United States. So unlike, you know, the classic novels where people have passports in like seven different names, that's more European anyway, I think. So you basically got her using...
She's got a lot of different names and a lot of different businesses all over the United States, and each one has its own numbers affiliated with it and its own bank account affiliated with it. And you'd have to know the name of the business in order to associate it with Meg's name.
I mean, let me tell you what, banks are getting really picky about because of all the money laundering and other stuff. I had to do a complicated transaction for the bookstore today, and it only went through because I remembered a check I wrote yesterday. It was the only validation that the guy on the phone from the bank would accept from me was, you know, what check did I write yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody but me would actually know that, you know, and I was fascinated. He didn't care about, you know, Social Security stuff, but it was more like,
anybody
if this
could
is your bank
that
account,
stuff.
What check did you write yesterday?
No, they're getting better at it. They're getting better
they
at
are.
It.
They're being forced to take a lot more protective measures. Mm-hmm. Then, do any of you have Gmail and you've been forced to go through this two-party identification?
You know?
That's a real pain in my opinion. The Mayo Clinic has just driven me insane with this patient portal because now they want, you know, a third party identification and all. So, you know, spies are, I love this, a discussion that we had and we're going to have again with Dan Festerman and Joe Cannon. Spies are going back to the old fashioned mail drop or, you know, sticking the note in the tree in the park or whatever it is because you can't hack it.
Yep.
And I think, wow, technology has, you know, maybe it's going to push us back.
It's exploded, and then now it's receding maybe a little bit, yeah.
Right. We're going to go back to more basic communication. Just think of all those people in front of the January 6th committee if they just written letters instead of, you know, photographing themselves and all the rest of it. I mean, talk about an illusion of privacy.
It really is.
It's like massive nurses.
It really is.
Right?
I know. Don't put anything in an email.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming this evening. Am I cutting anybody else off? No. All right. So I did say that for all our live events, we would be giving away a book. And I don't know. Did we actually do any numbers tonight? We probably didn't. So I've got to think up a question for Julie to ask because the book I've got is by Matt Goldman. And it's called Carolina Moonset, and it's our July notable new fiction book. Mm. Meg's book is our July crime book of the month. One of two, actually, because there was another one I really liked, so I'm forcing members of this club.
Oh, what is the other one?
Except it's a book we haven't got here yet by James Byrne called The Gatekeeper.
I don't know that one.
No, you wouldn't. Nobody does.
Okay.
But me. And it's the personality of the lead character, not the events in the book that are just irresistible. He's actually created a thriller hero that is very special.
Okay.
So I do try to vary things for the people in these clubs so they don't get the same book every month. You know, you want it to be different. Anyway, this book takes place in Beaufort, South Carolina, and it's about a really nice man from Chicago who returns home to help care for his father who has Lewy body dementia. And in the course of this, there's a murder. And the really fascinating thing about it is that the unreliable narrator is the father with Lewy dementia. And so you don't know whether he's actually the killer or not because he doesn't know. His memory, his short-term memory is gone.
Yeah.
So, the you know, I think that's
clever.
It's a really interesting variation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
On the unreliable narrative. Patrick and I talked to him at 5:00. I thought it was a fascinating discussion. So let me think. What question can you think that you might ask? We need a winner. What could you ask them about your work that somebody could guess? That's probably unfair.
That's hard. I'm not sure.
I can't either. Patrick, what are we going to ask?
Maybe where was the flight going on the fire on the first?
Are you disqualifying yourself?
I mean, I could get really specific, like what's the name of the airline that crashed?
Well, okay.
On the
ask
way to
that
Puerto
question.
Rico.
Is there
yeah.
anybody here who
I don't
can
know
answer
that anyone's
going to
get it.
No?
Yeah.
That one's...
I know, right? What is the name of the main head drug dealer in Berkeley that Eva works for?
You know that one, Merle?
Yeah.
Okay,
good.
You get
you
the
win.
Free book then. Hooray. I really love this book. And it is a paperback. We sold out of the hardcover, but it came out as a simultaneous paperback.
Oh,
and
good.
Hardcover. So we can do that. So, Merle, I will give that one to you. Thank you, Julie. It's
thank
really
you.
Been great to talk
thank
to you.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.